Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
Do you want a job, a career, or a true calling? You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. It might be possible to just stumble into the work you were born to do, but most of us are not so lucky. Beyond a rock-solid work ethic and keen understanding of our own strengths and talents, it takes good planning and sound decision-making to build a meaningful work life. To make those smart choices, my guest believes we can apply the same tactics businesses use to prepare for new ventures. Bill Barnett teaches career strategy at the Jones Graduate School of Business at Rice University. His new book is called The Strategic Career: Let Business Principles Guide You. Bill, welcome to Think.
Happy to be here, Chris.
What makes a calling different from a career or a job?
Well, that model of career calling job is really a powerful one. The person with a job is someone who you can really easily imagine. It's someone who comes to work, puts in their 8 hours. At about 4:15, they're beginning to look at their watch and thinking about what they're going to do that evening. They're not really committed to their work. For them, they're making money and keeping a job, and that's worthwhile. The person with a career is quite different. They're very ambitious. They're trying very hard to advance within their organization or perhaps to move to a better organization. They're hoping for the rewards that that advancement will bring, the money and the prestige. They're driven and they work hard and they often accomplish a lot. People with callings are, again, quite different. They're probably equally motivated as the career people are, but they emphasize in their own thinking the content of the work itself. They want to provide service. Maybe that's to a market. Maybe that's to a public. They want to achieve excellence at their craft, whatever they have picked to focus on. They want to build an institution. When they're making a career decision, they de-emphasize the role of money, power, or prestige. And one of the funny ironies is because they focus on the work itself, they often do so well that they get the promotion that leads them to the money, the power, and the prestige. But that's not where their head is. And once people have that calling mentality in the work they've found, they accomplish more, they're happier, they're more satisfied, and they just have a much more enjoyable and fulfilling work life.
Given the choice, it would seem that anybody would prefer to have a calling. Does everybody have that choice? Does everyone have the potential to find their calling?
I think just about everyone has the potential to find their calling. But over time, people can develop habits or attitudes towards work that don't lead them that way. The real question that I advise students on and that I advise people on in my own individual counseling is how to get yourself oriented towards the calling. And what I say is I say that you need to think about your values at work related to service, excellence at your craft, and institution building. Think about what fields or roles could you be finding that are within range of your current capabilities but can move you down the road towards service, craft excellence, or institution building, and really make that your primary brainstorming vehicle for what kind of career you want to pursue. And if you do that right, you're on a path that gives you the best shot at a calling.
So this doesn't sound like looking around to where the money is as we are undertaking an education.
It is absolutely not, but it often leads to money. Mm-hmm. So, most calling people, it isn't that they don't care at all about money. They want to be treated fair, but they won't jump around for a small raise from one employer to another. They won't emphasize the money or the power or the prestige instead of the opportunity to provide a service. And again, that service, it could be Mother Teresa, or it could be the founder of a new company that's going to serve a particular niche of the market that has a chance of really making lives better for the people who buy the product. So it can be a nonprofit organization, it can be an educator, it can be an attorney. As long as they have that calling mentality, they will be happy, more fulfilled, and have a greater chance of becoming excellent at their work and being more successful.
Some people are just not quite sure where they want to go. Some of us are lucky enough to be drawn to a certain profession from an early age. That makes acquiring the necessary skills relatively simple. You know where to go. If we're not sure what we're good at, what are the ways to figure that out?
In the mindset of a calling seeker, you want to be thinking about fields or roles where you can identify the ability to achieve those calling type goals. But then how do you find that? One of the interesting things that I talk about is some of the exercises people can do to stimulate their ideas. One very interesting idea is that I've seen work a lot with MBA students who are kind of 28 or 30 years old, is to think back to high school or maybe their first year in college when they were still teenagers and think about what they did after class. That's a good example. Or maybe it's your first day on your first job after you graduated from college. And you think about that, and suddenly people get ideas that they'd never thought about. One young woman that I knew, when she went through that exercise, it occurred to her that what she really had enjoyed most in college and high school was being on the tennis team. Now, she was now about 30, and she wasn't going to be a professional tennis player, not by a long shot. But that stimulated her thinking to try to find ways maybe to get into athletics administration at some university. And so that's an example of how that kind of brainstorming tool works. There are a lot of others.
It's such an interesting approach because we're always encouraged from a young age to look ahead, right? But we're not encouraged to think back on the things that have given us joy in the past.
Exactly right. And so that's one dimension. Another good example is to write the article that would be published about you in 20 years. Maybe in the New York Times, mm-hmm. you know, if you're a national figure, or maybe in your college's alumni magazine. And when you go through that exercise, and there's another version of that, which is to write your obituary, right. which is not quite as uplifting, but you tend to imagine things that you want to make sure you get done. And so that too can be a way of stimulating these ideas. A third example is really getting a deep understanding of your own strengths and trying to imagine that within a strength area, you weren't the way you are, but you're actually the very best in the country at that. And if you were, and of course, almost no one is, but if you were, what ideas might that give you that you could do? And when people do that, they often come back with just some really interesting ways of thinking about their possibilities.
You read about one guy who realized, I am really empathetic, and this allows me to be really good with people. And I can see how that would be valuable to a variety of employers in a variety of jobs. I'm wondering, though, how you turn that into something that you can communicate on a resume or in a job interview.
Yeah. Well, that guy in the book, I call him Pollab. He is an Indian American. And he had never thought of that about himself. And he went through several rounds of sort of struggling with what am I really good at. And he tried them out on resumes and so on. And he was coming back looking like a lot of other people did with his sort of resume history. And as he began to think about it, he said, I have to be distinctive. I have to do something different than these people I'm competing with. And what he came back with was the idea of empathy as it helps him think about new products for customers, because if you have empathy with the customers, you might think about better new product ideas. Empathy as it thinks about business partnerships. He was in an electronics company, and partnerships were a big part of that, and his role had a lot to do with partnerships. So if he could empathize with the partners, well, then he would do better with those relationships. And finally, empathy internally. He could be a better team leader or a better upwards manager if he really understood what the other person was getting at. Once he began to emphasize that in his a little bit in the resume, but more in kind of the kind of cover letter or the communication he would have when he had an interview for a position. Within 3 months, he found one job offer that he took. He had a couple of other promising things going, and he had been looking for work from his job for about a year. This stuff works.
So this, what you're not suggesting here is that someone finishing college or business school knows, okay, I'm going to work for company A for 4 years, and then I'll move on and do this, and then I might go back and try something else. The path is not necessarily that direct. You're not talking about planning out your future resume. You're talking about planning career moves, each of which will contribute something to your growth.
That's exactly right. I think Sheryl Sandberg, in her in some of her writing, conceived a very interesting thing. She said, it's not a career ladder. It's a jungle gym. And you think about jungle gym, the idea is you're always kind of going up the jungle gym. And there is a direct straight path up the jungle gym. But there's a lot of uncertainty as to whether that's going to actually happen in your life. And I think that's dead on. That what I've discovered is that people often can benefit from thinking about that linear development as to how they might go, but then just view that as one scenario for how your next 10 years might go. And instead, evaluate each opportunity that you have, thinking about where those opportunities might take you. And sometimes, of course, there's surprises because you get in an opportunity that you had that you were thinking about for one aspiration and it suddenly equips you for also for a second. And then you begin to have a problem. It's a high-class problem. Mm-hmm. But you begin to think about which direction is better for me. So sometimes they open up new options for you.
So often we have a job offer somewhere, and there is an element of risk, right? It might sound perfect, but you don't really know. You don't fully understand the corporate culture until you get there. You don't fully understand the demands on your time and energy. What's your sense of when to approach such a change with caution and when to just, you know, close your eyes and leap?
Well, I think that you're better off in every case if you do a full assessment. And the full assessment can have to do with many different kinds of things. First of all, it's getting the facts. You can't fully learn, for example, you mentioned organization culture. You can't fully learn everything about a culture until you've been there for a year or two. But you can learn some things about it. And you usually don't learn about culture by asking, so tell me, what's the culture like here? Because it's hard for people to answer that even if they want to, and maybe they can't. They feel like they can't be allowed to really say what they think in an interviewing or discussion process. But you can look around the edges. You can read the vision statement of the organization, read some other things in their public statements, and then just ask people, so how often does this happen? You know, or tell me some stories about that. And if you get a blank stare, well, then that's a little bit of a clue. You can observe how people treat each other. You can observe how they treat you during the interviews. Is it with respect? It may be tough. Maybe tough interviews, but is it with respect? You can judge a lot by asking people about career paths. Tell me about your career. What did you do in your prior three or four jobs, and how did they lead you to where you are? Is there anyone who is really a hero around here? Who are the heroes? So you can do a whole lot of inquiry like that that I kind of try to spell out in the book that allows you to get a handle on culture. Now, culture is only one thing. You have to look at the outlook for the industry or for the organization within the industry. You have to look at a lot of other factors, but it's...
I'm curious as to what, if you've been following the revelations about Amazon that have come forth, that it's a very challenging place to work, including for white-collar workers who maybe at other tech companies would have things a little easier. And there was a quote saying something like, well, when you're doing a moonshot, everybody has to give, you know, 110%. That's not a quote, but it's an approximation of the statement. But they're not doing a moonshot, right? They're a company that sells stuff to people and ships it around the world.
Well, I don't know anything about Amazon, so let me make sure that anything I say I'm just thinking about a little bit. My assumption is that there are practices at Amazon that the article in the New York Times made me a little bit uncomfortable about. And yet, I don't know how much out of line they are with other institutions that are trying really hard to kind of push the edge of their product category or their service category. It's not another moonshot, but I bet it's really hard to run a organization with that tight deliveries and that tight time frame and all the product that they have stocked.
We're speaking this hour with Bill Barnett, who teaches career strategy at the Jones Graduate School of Business at Rice University and is the author of the new book, The Strategic Career, Let Business Principles Guide You. If you've got a question or would like to make a comment, you can join us at 800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
The This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Bill Barnett. He teaches career strategy at the Jones Graduate School of Business at Rice University and is author of the new book, The Strategic Career, Let Business Principles Guide You. Join the conversation at 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Bill, how did it occur to you that business principles would work for helping us figure out the course of an individual career?
My main career, or calling, was as a partner with McKinsey & Company, the management consulting firm. And I was involved in the strategy practice of McKinsey. And when I left McKinsey, I had the opportunity to teach business students at Yale. And I was teaching a business strategy elective that I created. And I was assuming that they were going to come and talk to me after class about my brilliant cases or the wonderful discussion we had just had in class. And there was a little bit of that, but it was more they wanted to get advice about careers, about their job search, about what kind of thing they should try to make of themselves. And without even thinking about it in a conscious way, what occurred to me at the time in these conversations was to say something like this. Well, you know, 3 weeks ago in class, we talked about value proposition for products. It's ought to be the same thing for you. What do you, you're interested in the pharmaceutical, you know, technology management industry. What is your value proposition for that? And what I would see in their eyes is sort of like a light bulb popped on. And now these were MBA students who were studying business strategy principles, but I've since tried out similar things with executives and managers in both business, in nonprofit organizations. I've talked to a couple of religious leaders, some teachers, some attorneys, and physicians. This stuff works for everybody because it's intuitively sensible. And so it was kind of by accident that I discovered this. Well, once I discovered it, I sort of continued to do that, and it took 4 or 5 years of that repetitive thing for me to see a pattern. Mm-hmm. But once I saw the pattern, I said, I might have something big here. And so I started consciously trying to research it, and that led to my classes that I created in career strategy, and then that led to the book.
Another strategy that you recommend is sit down and imagine hiring yourself and sort of put yourself in the position of an employer looking at you for a particular position.
That is an old business strategy trick, too, because you try to think about why do I win sales for my product and why do I lose sales for my product when I win or when I lose. And I try to encourage people who are engaged in that endeavor to really take a fair-minded but kind of tough view of yourself and not to be pessimistic at all, but to really understand clearly why I would win and then why I might not win that job offer.
So when businesses are planning strategy, they have to think a lot about costs and they have to think a lot about the potential for failure. You definitely say we should all consider a game plan in the event that things, our next move doesn't work out the way we imagine it.
There are natural hedges you can have in place and consciously adopt when you're thinking about your careers and your positions that you're going to work through. And you have hedges by having other strengths. So, for example, some of your hedges might be the relationships that you have and that you continue to nurture. Because the relationships, your professional relationships, often are those that will give you access to other opportunities if this particular position that you have isn't working out very well. They often have to do with keeping your skills up to date and your knowledge up to date in a related field of work that you may have been in before. One of my favorite stories about that was a woman who named Shannon, who had a career for a couple, 3 years as a management consultant, then as an investment manager, and then she had children and her husband had to transfer and she dropped out of the workforce and then they moved back to the U.S. and by the time she was 50, she was divorced with several children and needed to work through what to happen. And it occurred to her, she said, you know, I've always been interested in healthcare information technology and I've kept up with it. And I probably kept up with it a little bit thinking that I might need it someday, but she was just interested in it. And she was able to leverage that, grow that skill in a new light and find a good opportunity as a result.
So all the things you're talking about here could also be applied to someone in midlife who thinks, I really want a different career.
Absolutely.
Or calling.
A different career or calling, better yet. And it's, you know, in a way, the playing field is wide open when you're 25 or 30. Because you may have had one or two positions along the way. You may have a graduate degree. You may have an undergraduate major. But when you're 45, you're more going to be building on things you've already done. Now, on the other hand, some 45 or 50-year-olds change dramatically. One woman I know well was an officer in a large organization, and she just decided she didn't like that anymore. And her hobby for years had been painting, and she became a full-time artist. And she's quite successful, shown in among the best galleries in one or two cities.
Something that you encourage people to pay attention to here is something that I think is really easy to gloss over, particularly before you have a lot of work experience, and that is this question of sacrifice, that people who are very successful will have to put more effort into their careers, have to say no to things that other people who are maybe less committed to their careers can say yes to.
When we earlier talked about the job career calling model, job people who are mostly about money are also about containing their sacrifice. They resist working on weekends. They resist working in the evenings. They resist other things where the work is making extra demands. They are unlikely to go very far. But the career people and the calling people make a lot of sacrifices. And virtually all of my MBA students have been prepared to do that. And most of the managers and professionals that I've counseled outside of class have been prepared to do that. There tends to be sacrifice in terms of job intensity. There tends to be sacrifice in terms of business travel. And, you know, often those sacrifices can be overwhelming. Sometimes people are asked to move to cities that they would rather not move to. Now, I'm not saying you have to sacrifice heavily every time. If you're motivated by career motivations for money and prestige, well, it's a pretty clear trade-off. If you're motivated by calling principles, it also can be a trade-off. If I want to accomplish a lot in my service goal or my craft-building goal, I'm going to have to sacrifice some things. I know you do, I do. But there have been many occasions when very astute people, in my own experience that I've worked with, have decided that the sacrifice at this particular time in their life had to be contained. And they went through a pretty rigorous, thoughtful process of thinking that through, and they decided not to. And so they decided to find something different. And I think that's a legitimate, absolutely fine thing to do. But it is pretty hard to advance in most organizations without a good bit of sacrifice.
You said your students tend to be, I mean, obviously they're very astute. They tend to be prepared to make those sacrifices. Thinking about what you're prepared to sacrifice at 23 at the start of your career is sometimes different than 20 years later when there are a lot of other things demanding your time and attention. A lot of
obviously,
other people demanding your time and attention.
Obviously family is a big factor there. That affects, you know, a lot of things about how you spend your time. Your role relative to your spouse in the context of family has a lot to do with the thinking. And then there also is the sometimes discomfort of moving. Because if one of two spouses both working and one of them has a great opportunity with a move, well, that uproots the other one. And so there are a lot of things like that that can change as you get older and as you get more more attached to other things.
How often should anyone who is in a role in a company or working some kind of job, how often should people reevaluate whether that job is still moving them forward in terms of, if nothing else, professional growth, even if not in salary and you know, level within the company?
Well, I argue that everyone should do an annual report, a personal annual report, maybe around the end of the year, maybe over holidays between Christmas and New Year's, or perhaps at your birthday, or one guy told me that he thought the best time for it was on April 15th, right after the taxes are paid. But to do an annual report on yourself, and what that includes is that includes looking at what you're doing, asking yourself the issue that you ask about, am I learning enough? Ask yourself, am I accomplishing enough? Ask yourself, am I happy with my relationships and my institution? And if you're not, then that tells you, well, you need to think about, can you change those things? And ideally, you can change them right where you are. And if you can't, well, then you have to start thinking about, should I think about something else? And by making it a discipline where you do it each year at roughly the same time, you can get in a pattern where it's not that hard to do. And if you prepare one page of kind of summary of that thinking each year, and you keep those pages, over the course of your life, you'll have your own personal work history all laid out. And it's a very nice thing to reflect on, and it can inform decisions. But the best way to do that is to do it routinely and treat it seriously.
I'm sure you've heard these stories, Bill. There are people who get so good at what they do that they're made into a manager of other people doing what they once did. Some people really thrive in those positions, and they act as mentors and guides. Other people find that they miss doing the sort of on-the-line work.
Perfect examples of that, and I've known several, are people who were the best seller in their division or in their business, and the best seller got the promotion to be the sales manager, and the best seller not only took away their best seller because he or she is now the sales manager, but they put the person into a role that they were not ready for. One of my favorite stories was of a telecom equipment manufacturer whose best seller they did just the opposite with. They set up a compensation scheme where that person could get rewarded just based on commission sales with what, in this case it was a man, what he was selling. And in one year, he made more than the CEO of the company.
Wow.
And I don't emphasize money, but if you think about that as a reward structure that makes people feel valued, that said a lot. There was some wisdom in that because the person in his craft where he was excellent had a chance to do really, really well and be recognized for it.
And it takes a certain courage to recognize that about yourself, to say a promotion might look better on my resume, but what I'm really happy doing is this work.
Well, absolutely. And whether it looks good on your resume or it's an aspiration you think you would have, apart from resume, it can well be that you've had this aspiration, but as you get closer to it, you kind of look at it and you say, you know, I'm not sure I'm cut out for that. And I've seen cases where people have been in that position. I think I probably was a little bit once or twice. And so it's there's nothing worse than being in a position that you're not well suited for. But you do want to stretch yourself, so don't. I'm not trying to encourage people to be lazy, but there's nothing that you want to do you don't want to do anything where you're not well prepared.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also join the conversation via email to think@kera.org, or you can find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink. What do you find to be the thing that holds people back, people who end up stagnating when they intended to sort of keep pushing?
I think that people who have trouble like that often are, first of all, they often are very focused on money and prestige and power, and then they don't get it. And they turn out they were trying for something that they weren't quite ready for, or maybe they would never be ready for. And they get discouraged, and they migrate from a career mentality into a job mentality. So that's one approach like that. What happens more often is people get comfortable. I had these aspirations. You know, now I'm kind of set in my life. I get comfortable, and, I'm making a pretty good income, and I'm doing work that's okay. And I kind of lose the aspiration I had in my 20s. And they ultimately may be preparing themselves to be a little disappointed when they're 48. And that's part of encouraging people every year to do this annual report, because I think you should take a very direct view of yourself and try hard to sort of say, so how am I doing kind of on my long-term aspiration?
Let's go to the phones now. We have Gabriella on the line in Arlington. Hi, Gabriella.
Hi, Chris. Hi. I am listening to your show. And everything that you're saying is ringing so true in my life right now. I've been out of work for 2 years, taking care of my kids. I'm getting ready to go back into the workforce. I was at corporate America, did not like it. I sacrificed, did not like it. For the last year and a half, I've been tutoring. With all the educational advances with Texas and with STEM, I'm really focused with my kids' education. So I'm able to understand what the requirements are for these kids in fifth grade, sixth grade, seventh grade, you name it. What does it require to graduate? So a year ago, I started tutoring, and parents will text me and say, hey, can you tutor today? And I text back and say, yes, I can tutor. And we'll meet at a library or at a coffee shop, and I tutor the student in whatever subject area they need. And they love it, and I love it, and they're learning, and they're happy. And I'm saying, maybe this is what I need to be doing. I'm loving it. Now, here's the thing. My idea is that I want to provide it for everybody for free. And when I talk to people about that, to create a nonprofit, sort of like it, a place where kids can come and get tutoring help, get homework help for free, kids, people say, how are you going to get paid? You're crazy. So my thing is, how can I do this? Who should I be talking to make sure that what my idea is actually what I should be doing?
Well, Gabriella has a big goal. She has a great passion. That's part of the formula, at least.
I like Gabriella's story a lot because the personal commitment to what you're talking about is very, very much like a service mentality that can create a calling. And I suspect in parallel, you're also kind of advancing your own skill at the craft of tutoring and advising people. So I think that's very good and a very nice path. The question of should it be a for-profit or a nonprofit venture that you would start is a different kind of thing. When I talk to people who are thinking about founding businesses, I try to separate the idea of what is best for you from whether you have a good idea for a business enterprise. By the way, whether it's profit or nonprofit, because a nonprofit is a business too. It just is cultivating donors or others to raise the funds. And so, Gabrielle, my advice is, first of all, I hope that you can pursue something like this. My second thought is that I hope that you can get advice and have a lot of discussions as to whether it's possible to set yourself up as a business like this, where you're actually billing fees, or whether you can attract donors to support you.
All right, we'll take a quick break now. My guest is Bill Barnett, who teaches career strategy at the Jones Graduate School of Business at Rice and is author of the new book, The Strategic Career, Let Business Principles Guide You. Join us at 800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Bill Barnett about his new book, The Strategic Career, Let Business Principles Guide You. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Bill, there is people's idea of what networks can do for them, and then there is the reality of how networks work. And it's a little bit counterintuitive that you don't necessarily want to rely only on the people that you have incredibly strong relationships with already.
You know, there's been a lot of research into networks. And one of the interesting things in professional networks is that most new opportunities that come related to network acquaintances don't come from your closest circle of friends, because you probably are already kind of aware of the things they're aware of. They come from the secondary circle of friends, friends of friends. And while at first that might sound kind of counterintuitive, that actually works pretty well because, number one, they probably know about things that you wouldn't naturally find out about. And number two, they wouldn't be putting that much on the line when they suggested that you follow a path, because a close friend is kind of taking a little bit of a risk when he recommends you for a position, whereas a distant acquaintance who thinks, well, she might really be a good fit here, that recommendation is easy. It's interesting. I'm glad you mentioned networks, because one of the most interesting findings that I have had in all of this is how important networks really are for finding opportunity. In all the people that I've counseled who have found new positions, including business school students who have a nice, good, positive career office to work with, more than two-thirds of the positions that they found came through network contacts, not through job boards, not through you know, very specific organization list of potential job openings and things like that. And the way people find networks is they find networks by helping other people. It's just a perfect sort of golden rule, almost like thing, is that when people are helpful to others in a professional way, without any kind of contract or kind of informal agreement, people just naturally want to help too. And so I've discovered that for people who have dense, very specific networks, or people who have broad, more loosely organized networks, you got to help people. And when you do, you get a lot of benefit from it.
That sounds so much nicer than the picture that many of us have of what networking means, which is showing up at some, you know, professional organization meeting and walking around the room and shaking 52 hands and collecting 52 business cards.
And that feels a little dishonest to most people, even if they don't realize it. They just feel a little bit uncomfortable. And, of course, the people they're doing it to are probably kind of in the same mindset. I used to think that whenever I went to some kind of conference, my goal was to meet one or two people. There might be 500 people there, but if I can meet two or three or one that I end up feeling like I could correspond with a little bit, well, that was a big bullseye.
800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Linda in Dallas. Hi, Linda.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. I was calling because I am a former teacher, and I left. It was a lot of pressure. I just found that the quality of my life just sort of decreased the longer that I taught. So I left about a year ago, and since then I haven't done any kind of paid work or anything. So now I'm just trying to figure out how to market myself for a different career with that sort of narrow experience and a small gap in my resume.
Do you know what you're good at and what you want to do, Linda?
I'd like to stay in the field of education, or at least work in nonprofit work. That's about as much as I know right now.
All right. Bill, any thoughts?
Yes. Linda, one of the things that I have seen people do when they're in a situation kind of like what you describe is to take their past work experience and get very clear and specific about what it is you think you know how to do pretty well. You know, it may be that you know how to engage a room of students pretty well. It may be that you know the specifics of the topics that you were teaching pretty deeply. And it may be that it's something else. Maybe you were also, while you were at the school, maybe you were a coach or a leader of some other extracurricular activity. And you get all that clear. Now, that's kind of like a resume. But what's different is that it's very much skill-based. And then you take those things and you try to brainstorm. And that doesn't just mean you by yourself. Talk to friends, talk to others, and try to find out what things are at least maybe not exactly what I was doing before, but what other fields of work or roles can make good use of this? And if you do that, there's a good chance that you'll find some things that you will be interested in and you will want to pursue. The other thing you can do is you can talk to friends, professional acquaintances, maybe some of your former colleagues at the school, and you can ask them, you know me pretty well. Do you know any stories of people like me and what they ended up doing? And do you have any suggestions for things I might consider? And most people, when they go down those kinds of exploration paths, come up with some good ideas about directions to pursue.
Just as there's a great emphasis in this country right now on getting into the right college, there's a great emphasis on getting the right first job. And I wonder how much we should worry about that and how much room there is for a little exploration in one's early career.
So let's think about the first job. I'm going to assume that it's a college senior right now, about to start or maybe started last week on their last year of school. And they know that graduation looms in May, and they need to find something between now and then. Of course, recruiters will be on campus at some point in the next several months. Now, there are two kinds of advice for these people that I've read. Some of them say, you must wait and be very careful and find your passion, and don't commit yourself before you find your passion. Find something you're passionate about and get started. That sounds kind of like my calling stuff, but hold on for just a minute. The second kind of advice is, it doesn't matter much what you do, just get started doing something. Now, I've even heard some people say both of those things, and they are in conflict. What I believe the right answer for a college senior in thinking about this is to be going through all these kinds of exercises we've talked about thinking about passion, but you're not going to find it. You're just going to begin to explore it. What you're looking for is a good first experiment. So if you think you might want to be a business executive, that's really something for more when you're in your 40s and 50s probably. But if that's what you'd like to do, well, maybe it's a particular kind of business that you're kind of thinking might be interested in. Maybe it in some way relates to your summer work experience or to your major. And so search for something kind of like that. But after you've kind of had that much direction, then you're looking for what seems to be the best fit of anybody that you meet. And recognize that you're going to be there for, unlikely you'll be there for a career. You might be there for 2 or 3 years if things go well. You might decide to go back to graduate school, or you might go to another company. And I think by trying hard to find something that's a good general fit rather than searching for a passion is the right strategy, and it'll get you the kind of experience. It'll get you started in a good way.
Outside of professions that would require postgraduate education just to start working in the thing people want to do, does it make some sense to get a little work experience under your belt and then go back to grad school?
I think it does for most people, because I don't think most people are really prepared at age, really 21, when you're beginning to apply to grad schools, assuming you graduate from college. I don't think it makes much sense for them to invest 2 or 3 years in more education unless they're really sure that's what they want to do. Now, most med students and most law students are doing just that. And I hope that most of them are really committed to those paths when they make that commitment. When you enter med school, you're committing yourself to 4 years of med school and then to who knows how many years, depending on your specialty of training. So it might be that you're 30 or 32 before you're done with all your training and ready to really have a full-scale practice. When you're going to law school, it's typically 3 years, and then you are really starting your first real job full-time at age 25. For most people that aren't like those, there's a lot to be said for working for a couple of years, certainly before you go back to business school. Or, you know, if you want to be an artist, I don't think I'd go straight to, the Rhode Island School of Design or the Yale School of Art. I think I would wait a few years. I think I'd try to see how do I like being an artist. I'd try to find a couple of jobs related to that, and I'd paint a whole lot on the weekends and in the evening. And then over time, if I really see the passion and if my work is growing, well, then maybe I can get into a top art school. I think that kind of principle is good for almost everything.
Back to the phones now at 800-933-5372. We have Tarek on the line in Dallas. Hi, Tarek.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Had a quick question for Bill. Actually, interestingly, this summer I came across his book, and I bought it for my son, who is this week starting at Rice as a freshman. He's read the book, and one of the key things that I stressed upon him as he started his undergraduate career was focus on building critical thinking and analytical skills. And I would like to hear some thoughts from Bill on that as to the importance of these skill sets as kids go through college.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you, Tarek. Congratulations on your son getting into the Rice undergraduate program. That's a challenge, and it's a good achievement. He must be a very smart and qualified person. I think that for almost everyone, a good undergraduate education involves a lot of development of good critical thinking. That's true if you're majoring in a liberal arts side on history or communications or English literature. It's certainly true if you're on the science and technology side. It's true in economics. All those things, if you pursue those right with good rigor, if you learn rigor, you're going to be well prepared for almost everything. Now, analytical skills are kind of like that, but if you meant quantitative analytical skills, I think everybody ought to be exposed to it. Some people just are more interested in it than others, and they major in mathematical economics or in you know, physics or some of these other very quant courses. But even the liberal arts majors will benefit from the critical thinking, and indeed a lot of the writing that they do are very much about that. So I think you're exactly right in recommending that. Another point that's kind of related to that is as you're choosing a college major, there are some majors that prepare you exactly for a job. If you major in accounting, for example, if you major in elementary education, for example, you're getting the equipment, the knowledge, together with the certification that can allow you to go out and get a job. If you're majoring in Hispanic studies, it's harder to find jobs that relate exactly to that. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the Hispanic studies major was the wrong one for you, because it has a whole lot to do with your interest, your orientation, how much of that critical thinking you develop in the context of that. And sometimes the liberal arts majors perform very well. In fact, at McKinsey & Company, I remember there were occasional discussions of someone who was coming in with a master's or a PhD in philosophy. And what could be more different than management consulting with Excel spreadsheets and all this? And we took some risk on some of those people, and they did usually quite well. And they were very critical thinkers.
How are you still using these tactics to plan your own career?
I am. It's more about kind of post-main work life planning. Mm-hmm. And I use these tactics exactly. And in fact, now, Chris, my calling is to try to help people find callings. And I'm so delighted to have been here with you today and to talk to some of the people on the phone.
Are there questions that people ask you that you think, this is a great question, but only you can figure it out? I mean, I would think a lot of the things that are in this book are really, there is not another person that can answer some of these.
I don't think there's another person that can answer anything here. Mm-hmm. I do think that there's a wisdom gained that I've gained some of, but a lot of it is just philosophers and religious thinkers who, if you think about it over time, they're providing advice a bit like this. Be true to your skills, do good things for other people, they'll be helpful to you, focus on service or craftsmanship as opposed to the money and the power. So I think there's a lot of history behind some of those general ideas, some of those principles, but how that applies to a person, it's up to them. In fact, one of my people that I spent a lot of time with, who is mentioned in the book, named Craig, he was actually a little disappointed after we first met for the first time, because he said, you didn't give me an answer. And I said, well Craig, I don't know what the answer is. I'll be happy to meet with you a couple more times and we'll see what. And at the end of it, he was quite flattered. He said, there's no way you could have known the answer. And I said, no, I know the process.
Right. Bill Barnett teaches career strategy at the Jones Graduate School of Business at Rice University. His new book is The Strategic Career, Let Business Principles Guide You. Bill, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Lauren Aguirre. Our executive producer is Jeff Winnington. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.